This is an iHeart podcast.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations. Thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whatever team Fee is on has a chance to win a championship.
I'm Christina Williams, host of the podcast, In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams. The WNBA playoffs are here, and I've got the inside scoop on everything from key matchups and standout players to the behind-the-scenes moments you won't find anywhere else.
It's really, really hard to be the champions, but we have to remember how it feels and embrace the new challenge that we have.
So listen to In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams, an iHeart Women's Sports production in partnership with Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A late stage republic. We talk about that a lot, as far as what we are as a nation. And let me explain a couple things about being a late-stage republic. As we talk about America, like it's going to be a great special. We're going to talk about us crumbling a bit. We're going to talk about the other nations who might take over for us at some point in time. But before we get into any of that, allow me to just do this. Maybe as an American, maybe you, like me, and I admit I'm one of these people, maybe you look at what's happening in your country as we begin to falter and fall. And you say to yourself, I'm really bummed, I hate this, I don't want this. That's fine that you feel that way. I'm glad you feel that way. I feel that way. But you should also understand this. It's the year 2023. Okay, what does that mean? When did the country start? 1776. Where does that put us? Almost 250 years, right? About that 250-year mark. You know how long, historically, most significant empires last 200 to 300 years. That's about what you've got. Now, maybe that doesn't make you feel better at all, but you should know this is how it goes. What I'm about to describe for you, this is how it always goes. You start out and things are good and you have good patriots and great people running the country, and the country has a new idea like we did, the idea of freedom, and everyone loves it and they embrace it and we go all in, and then the country grows and it's ambitious and things are going really well, and things get going so well that you just get so rich and so far removed from your founding that you lose your way. And the people who want to pick at the bones and tear your country down, they don't like that you're number one. People inside your borders and outside of your borders, which we'll talk about a bit tonight, they see an opportunity. They see a population that's fat, complacent, lazy, bored, and just doesn't want to protect the thing they have. And things just start rotting. Slowly but surely, they start rotting. That's all you're seeing here. And now we're probably at the stage where things will pick up in pace a little bit. No, America's not going to fall tomorrow. I'm not doing any of that doomsday stuff. But we're at a place now where we have failed multiple times, and we've failed on the world stage. And that in and of itself, that is the problem. I've been doing a lot of reading lately. We'll get to America in a second, but I've been doing a lot of reading lately on Napoleon and his various conquests and whatnot. And he's one of these historical characters that I have a real love-hate relationship with. He's so fascinating and talented at the same time, just horrible about some things. But one of the things I always find sad about the Napoleon story, every time I read it, is there's this great general and he's conquered so much and all these lands and everyone's scared to death of him. But then towards the end, when he loses a battle here, there, they all just start coming for him. The second they see the king bleed a little bit, they start coming for him. And from there, it was already over. That's what we are right now. Do you remember? You remember Afghanistan? Now, this building up to this moment took a long time. I don't want to act like it was just one singular moment that really brought all this about. That would be a huge oversimplification. But this was the moment The world found out, oh man, we got a late stage republic over here. You see, it's one thing to fail. It's one thing to embarrass yourself. It's another thing to do it publicly. If I go home tonight when I'm done doing the show for you, and I walk in and I'm eating dinner and I'm walking around the house and I accidentally stub my toe and I stub it so bad I trip and fall and bang my knee on the ground, well, that sucks, right? That's not fun. That hurts. A little bit of humiliating, but not that big of a deal. It's just me at the house, maybe the wife and kids. If I, however, have to go give a speech somewhere in front of 10,000 people and I do that when I'm walking out on the stage, that's a whole different problem entirely. It's one thing to have some embarrassing things happening within the borders of your nation. It's another thing to have each and every country on the planet look at their television screen and watch you stub your toe and bang your knee and fall flat on your face and embarrass yourself. Afghanistan, the disastrous withdrawal, that was America sending the bat signal to the world that we ain't what we used to be. I told you this back in 2021. You should feel embarrassed on behalf of your nation because we look terrible to the rest of the world right now. There's not a way to put it. This is an international embarrassment. America has been the global superpower for your entire lifetime. It has. We took over that rule right about the end of World War I. That's when we really became top dog. And we've been top dog ever since. That's about 100 years. The world is looking right now, and they're asking, are they still top dog? I mean, this is not what the top dog does. This is what some fading power does. And what happened? After that was done, what happened? Russia goes marching into Ukraine about 15 minutes after that happened. Now we're mired in a crappy war there. And look, other nations know it. And again, back to the Napoleon thing, this is one of the things I notice every time I read about it, how they just start, they're trying to feel him out, the other nations. And they're trying to figure out, is this the same guy who never loses a battle? Am I about to lose here? And so what they really try to do is they start just poking him in the ribs a little bit. Just kind of like you'd be with like a rabid dog you're trying to get away from. Just kind of poke him with a stick and back away. Is he going to get me? Well, that's what they're doing with us right now. Just trying to feel us out, see what we're made of. Remember when the Chinese sat down just after Joe Biden got elected, sat down in front of the Secretary of State and essentially told him, you ain't running things around here anymore.
So let me say here that in front of the Chinese side, the United States does not have the qualification to say that it wants to speak to China from a position of strength.
Ow. You don't get to talk to us from a position of strength. And maybe when you watched that clip initially, maybe you were filled with this, wait a minute, yes, we do. I know I was. Hey, who do you think you are, China? Maybe we were wrong. Maybe we were wrong. After all, not only did they just fly a spy balloon from coast to coast, from the Pacific to Atlantic here in the United States of America, embarrassingly, the president of the United States met with the press and said he wanted it shot down, but they told me no.
Briefed on the balloon, ordered the Pentagon to shoot it down on Wednesday as soon as possible. They decided without doing damage to anyone on the ground. They decided that the best time to do that was as it got over water.
I told them to shoot it down.
On Wednesday.
On Wednesday.
But the recommendation.
They said to me, let's wait till the safest place to do it.
They said to me? So someone's ordering around the commander in chief? That's where we're at now? This guy, Mark Milley, the guy who promised China he'd warn them if we were going to attack?
As part of that conversation, I said, General Lee, there's not going to be a war, there's not going to be an attack between great powers. And if there was, the tensions would build up, there'd be calls going back and forth from all kinds of senior officials. I said, hell, General Lee, I'll probably give you a call, but we're not going to attack you. Trust me, we're not going to attack you.
A late stage republic. And You know, there are a million examples. I use Napoleon off the bat. Maybe Rome is a really good one, too. Just that you have this gigantic juggernaut superpower who forever could dictate terms to whatever country they felt like dictating terms to. If Rome said jump, you said how high. And then internally, they were rotting and rotting and rotting. And this took place over a long period of time. And then eventually, these various tribes, from the Huns to the Vandals to all the, they start picking at the bones and picking at the bones and poking at the ribs and poking at the ribs. And soon, what's happened is you've let the world know that the unstoppable, the great juggernaut, isn't really a great juggernaut anymore. The great juggernaut eventually becomes painted rust. And once the world finds out that the great juggernaut is painted rust, you're in a lot of trouble because they remember all those years they weren't number one and they want to come make sure you remember how you treated them. All that may have made you uncomfortable, but I am right. This is all while we have a military that is rotting out from underneath us, as always happens with these late-stage republics. We're going to talk to Green Beret Joe Ken about that next.
We don't need a military that's woman-friendly. We don't need a military that's gay-friendly, with all due respect to the Air Force. We need a military that's flat-out hostile. We need a military full of Type A men who want to sit on a throne of Chinese skulls. But we don't have that now. We can't even get women off of naval vessels. That should be step one, but most of them are already pregnant anyway.
Forgot how mad the Chinese got mad at me about that. They're furious. Joining me now, one of those men, by the grace of God, they still exist. Joe Kent, Green Beret, combat veteran, former congressional candidate, and hopefully, I believe, running again. Joe, you're running again in Washington, right?
I am, Jesse. We're back in the fight.
Yes, my man. Joe Kent is running for Congress again. One of the few people I 100% support in this country. All right, Joe, so let's set aside some stupid take I did on Tucker Carlson. We're shooting down a lot of things. Apparently, we're missing some of these things as well. We actually dropped a $400,000 Sidewinder somewhere, and no one seems to know where it is. Joe, what am I missing?
You know, look, I mean, the Biden administration just doesn't take our security seriously. We knew that before they opened up the border for an invasion. And then this nonsense with Chinese spy balloons, Chinese spy craft, they won't give us any straight answers. And look, I think initially they were caught off guard. They hadn't seen these things before. They had left that entire northern frontier wide open, and they're backpedaling right now. And really, they know that the mainstream media is just going to help them cover up their incompetence and really just their negligence.
Joe, it seems like we're watching everything crumble around us. It goes way beyond, you know, military stuff, but let's focus on that there. It doesn't feel like we have the same proficiency we have known, that we've always known as Americans. It's been that way my whole life. Always the biggest, always the best, always on point. It feels a little rotting now, but you're the one with the experience, is it?
Most certainly is. I mean, look, what Joe Biden has done to our military, Joe Biden, Lloyd Austin, what they've done to our military in a short period of time is nothing short of absolutely catastrophic. They received one of the most battle-hardened forces, the force that fought the global war on terror for 20 years. They received them, and they, you know, put the vaccine mandate on them. They put the extremist stand down on them, where they automatically said, hey, we think any of you who are on the opposite side of the aisle as the ruling power, we think that you are domestic terrorists. And then, like I said, the vaccine mandate, we've just eroded and eroded, and we put all these different woke talking points as our priority, as opposed to just war fighting. And look, at the end of the day, our enemies see this. There's no way in heck that China would have taken these drastic and very dangerous and very provocative measures against the United States if President Trump, or really any previous president, was in the Oval Office, because they didn't think they could get away with it. And now under Biden, they are completely and totally emboldened. So there's a direct result at what our ruling class, what our political leaders, Joe Biden and Lloyd Austin, what they do to our military and our national security.
Joe, what do we talk about when it comes to these high altitude balloons, satellites, various ways that people spy today, that nation states spy on others? Look, I'm just an idiot. What information can they gather? Can they gather valuable information? 60,000 feet, that's pretty high. What are they getting?
It is. Look, I mean, there's a lot of technical collection that they could get from these balloons or these other types of crafts. However, look, at the end of the day, you know, I served in the military and special forces. I was also an intelligence officer in the CIA. Every time you go to do an operation like this, you do risk versus gain. And the Chinese had to assess that, hey, look, we're not really risking much. Under any other administration, the risk would have been really high. Hey, boss, I want to float a balloon over an American nuclear installation. I think most of the time the answer back would have been, are you crazy? You're going to start a nuclear war. But with Biden in the White House, they were like, yeah, what the heck? Let's give it a whirl. I personally think that the Chinese could have collected sensitive information from their satellites or from all of the different operatives they have deployed on the ground here in the United States, buying up farmland by these nuclear installations. I think that this was meant to send a message that they control the time and place in which they can attack us. And that also, look, at the end of the day, they have our ruling class, especially the Biden crime family, they have them at their behest.
Joe, is this as simple as, well, here's a little video clip of Joe Biden not remembering Austin's name.
I want to thank all of our distinguished guests that are here today, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Secretary Austin, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of the military behind me.
Joe, is this as simple as a commander-in-chief problem? We have a dementia-riddled old man who can't speak, can't remember anybody's name, and that's the reason this is rotting, or is the rot deeper?
The rot's much deeper. It's way too easy to give Biden a pass and just say, like, oh, he's an old man of dementia. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's sleepy Joe. Yeah, I mean, that factors when you're talking about a press conference. However, at the end of the day, Joe Biden is a career politician, 50 years in government. He has been in the back pocket of the Chinese Communist Party now for decades, going back to when he was on the Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. The Hunter Biden laptop is very real. It speaks for itself. It shows the level of compromise that the Chinese Communist Party has on Biden, not to mention oligarchs in Ukraine. So this is a deeply corrupt person who, at the end of the day, him and the vast majority of the people on his national security team, they don't believe there's anything exceptional about America. I don't think there's any kind of secret cabal of globalists plotting against us. What's even more dangerous is this mentality that, hey, this expert class of corporatists should be in charge of everything, and we'd be much better off having closer relations with people in Brussels than we would be having relations with people in, you know, East Palestine, Ohio.
Joe, what are you hearing from the hardcore types who are still in? Because there are many, many great men and women still in the United States military. They want the right things. They're there for the right reasons. But if your emails look anything like my emails, they're not going to be in very much longer. Jesse, I'm getting out. Jesse, I'm getting out. Jesse, I'm getting out. Now my son's not joining. Jesse, I'm hearing a lot of this. Are you hearing this?
I'm hearing the exact same thing, unfortunately, and it's very dangerous because, like I said, I mean, these guys, they're the ones who really bore the burden of 20 years of constant combat, and we need these guys to stay in and bring up the next generation of soldiers. And the vast majority of them, if they haven't already gotten out, they're going to do the bare minimum until they can get their retirement, and then they're going to get the heck out of the military, which is dangerous if you look at how the recruiting's going, because we're not able to put folks into the military to fill those gaps. So I think it's incredible, especially with Joe Biden taking us, you know, ever so close to a kinetic war with Russia and Ukraine.
Joe, fix it for me. Joe Kent is a dictator for a year. How do we fix America's military? We love our military. We're proud of it. We're used to being number one. We don't want to watch this rot happen. What fixes this?
Yeah, I mean, first and foremost, the vaccine mandate, it's good that we got rid of it, but we need to bring back everybody who was kicked out, make them whole again, give them back their rank, give them back pay. That's number one. And then get rid of all this woke nonsense. And that's easier said than done because it's so deeply ingrained. I think we need to remake our officer corps. We need to start bringing in a lot more guys from the enlisted ranks to become officers so we can cut the university indoctrination system out of how to groom our military leaders. And from there, we need a foreign policy that is America first. We don't need to have a combat division plus sitting over in Poland, sending the vast majority of our military resources into Ukraine for a conflict that we don't need, that we don't benefit from, that we'll only lose in. We need to get very serious about restoring economic dominance and really getting back to being energy dominant. Once again, energy independent, energy dominant. Really, at the end of the day, it's like you said in that opening clip with Tucker, our military has one purpose, and that is to kill people and to break things. The second they start trying to do anything else, they are veering into a very dangerous area that makes our country less safe. We have to get back to just war fighting as far as our military goes.
Amen. Joe Kent, I appreciate you, brother.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
All right. Jack Posobiec is going to join us. What is the capability of China? What can they do? Hang on.
Have relations now between the U.S. and China taken a big hit,
no.
frankly?
No.
How do you know?
I know. I talked to him.
You've talked to
Xi Jinping before. Our team talks to their people.
During this and
yeah,
since?
Yeah, after this. I haven't talked to him during this.
Oh.
What? Joining me now, Jack Posobiec, host of the great Human Events Daily podcast. Also, a Navy veteran. I don't like that, but it is what it is. All right, Jack, what is our relationship with China? I know we're enemies, we're friends, we're enemies who need each other. What is it?
Well, so, I mean, there's a lot of ways you can answer that question, but the reality is this, is that China has always, for the last 30 years or so, been the partner in crime of the elites in this country. When all of our jobs were shipped overseas, the deal was manufacturing will go to Asia. So we're going to remove manufacturing from the steel belt, will become the rust belt. We're going to remove it from the Midwest. We're going to remove it from the South. It's going to go to East Asia, particularly China, so that they can pay slave wages. The Western capital and the intellectual property will be our angle of it. So the people who were shipping all the jobs over there got filthy rich, while all the wealth, the jobs, the employment, the growth, that all went to China. The backstop of it in included in all of this was that the IMF and the World Bank would be going in funding all of their rise with loans. So, you know, there's a reason that Chicago and Detroit look the way they do, and Shenzhen and Shanghai and Beijing look the way that they do, because we paid for that. Our wealth was transferred to China. However, on the military side, we also you have the military-industrial complex, which always must put China out as a rival, as a major threat. So they seek to portray China as this, and it's kind of this interesting track where China as a military threat, and by the way, they are, by the way, an actual threat to the United States, at least in terms of Taiwan, in terms of our partners in East Asia, Korea, Japan, etc. But when it comes to it, we have this sort of dual relationship, which I think you were kind of getting at there, that we are deeply in bed with them economically, and yet we look at them also as military rivals. What you're actually seeing is a fight at the highest levels of globalism, right? So that system that I just outlined, that's globalism. That's what that is. We outsource but also our energy policy to the Middle East. So manufacturing in East Asia, Middle East gets our energy policy. But underpinning all of that is that the United States, the West, is supposed to be the senior partner. Well, now all of a sudden, here comes Xi Jinping and here comes the resurgent CCP. They want to be senior partner now. We saw this all throughout COVID. We saw this through just last week when they decided to send a spy platform, this dirigible, over our nuclear silos, basically telling us, oh, you think you're in charge? It's like that scene in Batman, you know, you think this gives you power over us? No, we have power because we have all the wealth, we have all the manufacturing, and you handed it to us. Here's your cheap, big screen TVs, and you can sit and swipe on your Netflix. Well, we'll be building a real army and a real military, and you guys can go have, you know, pronoun Thursday.
Jack, I have a bunch I want to nail down on, but let's nail down on the military part of this. What can they do beyond Taiwan and making life miserable for the Koreans and things like that? What can they do to us here on the mainland as an American citizen. I live in rural Texas. What can they do to me, to my friends, to my neighbors? Anything? Nothing? Everything?
Well here's the thing. I mean, particularly when it comes to China, I would not. Their military is geared towards regional threats. Their military is geared towards attacks within Asia, within what they call the island chains, first, second, third island chains, all the way up to Guam, maybe hit Hawaii if there was an actual World War III scenario that kicks off, which, by the way, if you look at the way things are going with the United States right now, we're escalating into a hot kinetic war in Ukraine while we're also escalating in the South China Sea and the Taiwan Strait, so maybe. But more directly, I think what you'd be looking at is, number one, they're going to be spying on you. We saw that, of course, with last week, where, and I took a lot of incoming for saying this, that I think that balloon was clearly looking at cell phone signals as well as all sorts of personal signals. The State Department later came out and confirmed that. But you're also looking at cyber attack. Jesse, you understand that their cyber capabilities are such, they understand they're not going to defeat the United States in an open war, so they don't want to fight it that way. What if you all of a sudden you can't, because all of our lives are so connected to any type of cyber system, your banking, your car, your GPS. Imagine all of that goes down for every American at the same time. And I'm not just talking about Twitter goes down. I'm talking about all of the ways that we run our lives. You can't even make it to the next town. You can't even, trucks don't know how to go where they're going. Everything breaks down overnight. Banking completely breaks down. That is exactly the threat that I would see from the Chinese Communist Party when it comes to this. As far as a direct threat, the long-term threats, of course, the transfer of wealth, and if another one of their bio experiments decides to escape from a lab, we might have to deal with that again.
Jack, why would they be collecting cell phone signals? Whose cell phone signals? I'm stupid. I understand. So you need to explain this to me. What does China gain by collecting my cell phone signal? I'm on the phone with my father. What do they gain by that? I know it's something, but what?
Well, for you, maybe not so much anything, but of course, maybe they are looking at you in terms of, they're looking at patterns of behavior within American society. So if they say, hey, here's a guy, he hosts a show, he's talking to government leaders, he's talking to influential people inside the United States, they're mapping out power networks, they're mapping out influence networks. When it comes to bases, they're going to say, who runs the base? Who runs the, who are the guards? Where are the guards working with? What are these trucks that go in and out? Oh, that's the food delivery. What company does the food delivery? Who works for them? What are the logistics? What are the supply runs that go back and forth? What's the frequency? How do you get in and out? What are the codes that we use for all of these things that we put on our basic? And we saw this in the Navy, by the way, how they could look at our fire control, they could look at our Aegis, our early warning radars, but what about signals that we send to power the lights, to run the engine, to just have basic electricity throughout the ship? Are those systems as safe as the ones that we use to run our weapon systems? Not exactly, but guess what? If we don't have the security controls on them, then what happens to your ship if all of a sudden you can't drive it across the ocean? What if you get stuck somewhere? What if you can't turn your engine on? You've just neutralized that as well. So they've really been investing heavily in these cyber programs, and it doesn't surprise me at all that their surveillance would have kicked up to another notch where they're sucking up these types of signals.
Jack, why did we let the balloon get clear across? Now, I have my own theories, but I'm positive you have one. It doesn't make sense. Republican, Democrat, it doesn't make sense. Why would any president, any administration allow the thing to go from the Pacific to the freaking Atlantic before they shot it down? Why?
I mean, Jesse, look, I said this the night that it happened live. This is what it feels like to be in a vassal state. This is what it feels like to be completely owned, to have an administration and a government. And you see this on both sides of the aisle. That is, so we talked earlier about the dual relationship that the United States has with China, where they present a military threat to us, but financially, our leaders are deeply in bed with them. This is exactly exemplifies what I just said there, because they're more interested in their dollars and cents, their yuan and renminbi that they can get in terms of these deals rather than any of these they're willing to overlook the military threats because of the massive amount of billions and trillions of dollars in generational wealth that's going to come through that relationship. So if a spy plane goes across, they're going to allow it to happen, and then they're going to blow it up after where it leaves U.S. territory, where they're not even really using it anymore at that that point, and they're going to beat their chest and make it out like they're taking some big care of it. But at the end of the day, I think that was a message. I think that was a message to the American people, and I think we all saw it, that we are owned, and our new management is not in Washington, D.C. It is in Beijing.
Dang. All right, Jack, finally, what's their weakness? Make me feel better, because I feel like crap now. What? We like to imagine this big red dragon, you know, this all-powerful red dragon. They see everything, they know everything. But they've got weaknesses, everyone does. What are they?
Well, so one of the biggest weaknesses in China is that once you get past the coastal sections of China, you're still dealing with numbers that we can't even imagine, can't even fathom in the United States. 700-800 million people still living in poverty in that country. People who, if they realize that they are the ones being kept in those conditions by their elites that are really only operating in order to enrich themselves rather than do anything for the country, then if those people were somehow able to be turned on the regime itself, just like any other dynasty in China, they believe in this thing called the theory of dynastic cycles, where each dynasty throughout Chinese history has had this sort of cycle of growth, superiority, decline, decay, and then a new revolution puts a new dynasty in place. So if you look at the Communist Party as just another one of the dynasties of China going back for 5,000 years, it certainly fits into that. So you get a lot of those regional issues, you get a lot of situations where like this, but it's also why the Chinese Communist Party uses the United States as a scapegoat, uses the Taiwan situation as a scapegoat, because they're fanning the flames of really ultranationalism, hypernationalism, that only the Chinese Communist Party can protect you from the outside. Only the Chinese Communist Party can return Taiwan, can return Hong Kong from the Western imperialists. Only the Chinese Communist Party. And so this is the way that they keep their hold on people, to be able to say that we are the ones that must fight back. So yes, do they have weaknesses? Do they have issues? Absolutely. But the same issues, guess what? We got them too.
Jack, appreciate you, brother.
Thanks so much, Jesse.
All right. What about Russia, though? Boris Rivkin. His name's Boris. You think he knows what he's talking about? He's going to join us next.
The idea that we're going to send in offensive equipment and have planes and tanks and trains going in with American pilots and American crews, just understand and don't kid yourself, no matter what y'all say, that's called World War III. Okay? Let's get it straight here, guys.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine.
Okay, so are we in World War III? Is this the early stage of it? One of the smartest human beings I know, especially when it comes to that region, is my friend Boris Rivkin of Monofly Holdings and the Get Deals Done newsletter. Boris, okay, we said it was going to be World War III. We sent them. It doesn't feel like World War III, but maybe we're in some kind of soft cyber version of World War III. Where are we when it comes to U.S.-Russia relations right now? Obviously, they're not good.
I think that the World War III card has been overplayed to some degree in terms of on the Russian side. In other words, it's in their interest to continue to increase the rhetoric, to sharpen it, to offset the problems that they have at the front and their lack of their diminished capabilities, essentially. So it's rhetoric as a Potemkin village, almost strategy to conceal their own problems and the worsening situation in Ukraine for them right now, practically. So in reality, that's why Putin, for example, keeps defaulting to the nuclear card. You notice that it's sort of a diminishing return on using it, because he threatened to use it if we send any heavy weapons to Ukraine at all. He threatened that there would be consequences if we sent the HIMARS, if we sent the anti-ship missiles that were used to sink their battle cruiser Moskva in the Black Sea. He threatened consequences if we increase the range of the howitzers and the long-range artillery that we would be sending to them, sending them more of those. And he said the same thing, that there would be consequences, and his former president of Russia, who's now really kind of a pathetic sap mouthpiece, Dmitry Medvedev, threatened all sorts of consequences, that the world would end if the tanks were sent, if the Germans signed off on sending the Leopard tanks that the Ukrainians wanted. So the more that we have pushed the envelope, the response has been largely rhetorical. So nothing has fundamentally changed from the Russian side militarily. They haven't upped the ante because I think they can't. And to a large extent, that has nothing really to do with Biden and what we're doing. It has to do with Russia's own internal problems and what Putin realistically can and can't do. So what Putin is essentially doing right now is he's telling his generals to accomplish political objectives for him. So by the one-year anniversary coming up at the end of the month, he told his generals, I want a couple of politically important positions in Ukraine in the Donbas region, like Bakhmut, where there's a huge amount of fighting going on right now. I want those positions taken. I want something that I could spin on the one-year anniversary as a big political victory for me, in light of the reality that the Russians have now lost north of 200,000, probably approaching 250,000 dead, wounded, and captured in Ukraine in 1 year. So in context, what does that mean for the Russians? So the Soviet Union lost about 10,000 killed in 9 years fighting in Afghanistan during the Soviet-Afghan War. So it's that's about three or four times what they lost in the two Chechen wars put together at this point. The first one under Yeltsin and the second one under Putin. So you basically just put that in context. That was the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. Here you have Russia, which has, the Soviet Union had about 300 million people. Russia now today has 140 million. And, you know, they lost 10,000 killed. The number killed in Ukraine is about 60 to 70,000. So it's a disaster. And they don't have anything else. As far as equipment, to technologically to offset that in any way. But Putin is setting these political objectives. And his generals are in panic, but they are terrified. They are doing what they can because there's a lot of, you know, to appease the czar, if you will, to appease Putin, there are a lot of these factional battles that are happening inside the Kremlin, each trying to kind of undermine his political rival, be it this guy who's the head of the Wagner Group, which is this mercenary private army, the chairman of their equivalent of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Gerasimov, chief of the general staff. Then you have the hapless defense minister, Shoigu, who's never served a day in his life in the army. You think it's kind of like some of the people we have in our military, but this guy never served a day in the army. And of course, because he was a Putin crony, he became defense minister. So his main job was robbing the defense budget. And now we're seeing what's going on there. So you have to separate the political rhetoric of Putin himself from what's actually happening on the ground and what they can do. And the final point on that, in terms of what more could happen here, like how close are we to the brink because we're hearing this? And when I said it's not as much to do with us, China is a huge restraining force on Putin. So aside from Putin's own internal limitations and what's happening within the Russian army and its inability to achieve anything that he really wants it to achieve strategically, the Chinese are a huge restraining force on Putin. So Xi basically told Putin, do not use nukes. You know, that there's been a lot of behind the scenes pressure. So the Chinese are helping Russia in some areas, but they're a huge restraining force on them in other areas. So the Chinese want a Russia that's sort of weakened and prodding. That would be a Russia that where they kind of have them where they want them. That would actually be useful to the Chinese. But if this escalates into them using even tactical nuclear weapons in Ukraine at all, that would be really, really problematic for the Chinese across the board. So they've been trying to get Putin to not go that far. So, and another interesting point, kind of to close that off, in terms of their capabilities. There was, I think it was about 5 or 6 years ago, maybe longer, the former deputy prime minister who was later the head of the Russian equivalent of NASA, Roscosmos, their space agency. And he was the deputy prime minister in charge of defense issues. And he gave a speech to their equivalent of the Pentagon and said that, and this was supposed to be off the record, but it was somebody filmed it and it was disseminated, that in his estimation, the U.S. could, within a matter of hours, knock out 80 to 90% of Russia's nuclear capacity with conventional weapons. So with targeted long-range conventional weapons with targeted missile strikes, without us even having to contemplate any kind of nuclear retaliation or second strike or anything, before they do anything. So before a single Russian nuclear device even gets off the ground, we have the conventional capability of destroying 80 to 90% of that capacity without any further problems. And he admitted this to their equivalent to the Pentagon. So they're fully aware of the disconnect between what they're saying as far as the nuclear threats and the gulf in capabilities between us and them. So you kind of have to keep all of those things in mind when you hear a lot of these scare stories, I think, about World War III being imminent.
Boris, finally, politically, you mentioned Putin's vulnerable politically, and I continue to hear this. He's vulnerable. We Americans, we like to imagine this all-powerful autocrat who has total control of everything. Why is a guy like that in trouble politically?
Well, I don't know if, to be honest, I think that that kind of dovetails to these rumors. Is Putin ill? Does he have cancer? Like, what's his staying power? What's going on? I wouldn't put too much credence into that. I think that it's too early to think about who might succeed Putin. What I can say is, or what's his real standing in the Kremlin? I think that for now, there's no one really who could challenge him directly. There are a couple of people who might together, but Putin has been able to set up a very specialized scheme. Obviously, he was a former KGB colonel. He understands what happened to Gorbachev when they attempted to overthrow him in 1991. Putin is very careful to keep close tabs on everyone around him. He hates them. He doesn't trust them. This is, you know, a late stage. He's been there for over 20 years. He suspects plots and attempted coups at every turn, behind every rock. And so he's very careful not to allow any potential rivals to gang up on him. So I wouldn't really put too much weight into that. And more importantly, the aspiration of Putin's successor being some kind of a enlightened pro-Western Democrat, I think we shouldn't keep our hopes up on that either. I think really what I can say is that, he does use body doubles, that we know. He does keep his senior advisors, you know, across these mile-long tables because he's literally has all these phobias. He's just terrified of them being around him. So he has a special train, armored train, that's prepared to, like Kim Jong-un, you know, that he so that's to not have too many people close to him. So he's taking every precaution he possibly can. I don't give too much weight to any of these rumors, but what I would probably say is that the war in Ukraine currently, whether it expands or doesn't, or there's some kind of strategic operational change in the battlefield, if you will, the war in Ukraine will continue politically so long as Putin is in the Kremlin. So for Putin, he is ideologically possessed with this Ukraine issue and has been for far longer than a lot of our commentators and officials, I think, have given him credit for. And when somebody is ideologically possessed with something, rational thinking goes out the window, which is why he's continuing to insist on all these really unachievable, deranged political objectives, which have no military, aren't militarily realizable. He doesn't care. So he wants to keep going. And so we have to decide, that could sort of dovetail to what we need to do at this point. How will this end? How long is this going to go on? I mean, we have to decide what our tolerance is, meaning are we prepared for a multi-year potentially, which I think could very well be the case, of a sort of lower grade protracted war, another Afghanistan, another Vietnam type of experience in more of a proxy setting where we would be providing some kind of open-ended support for Ukraine as the front begins to sort of ossify and solidify and we get into this war of attrition stalemate situation? Or are we prepared for a new definition of what we would be fine with as far as victory is concerned over there, because we have other priorities like China and things that we have to be focused on? So that's a political decision for us. But on Putin's end, I don't believe he's going to be stopping so long as he has the ability to keep going.
Boris Rifkin, thank you, my brother.
Thanks, Jesse.
We have final thoughts. Next. All right. That's a lot, right? You're thinking about foreign powers. How are they? How are we trying to assess World War III, which is ugly anyway, but let's stay on top of it around here. Obviously, World War III doesn't matter until it matters a lot. We'll let you know. We'll do it again.
You want smart political talk without the meltdowns? We got you.
And I'm Carol Markowitz.
And I'm Mary Catherine Hamm. We've been around the block in media, and we're doing things differently.
Normally is about real conversations, thoughtful, try to be funny, grounded, and no panic.
We'll keep you informed and entertained without ruining your day.
Join us every Tuesday and Thursday.
Normally, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Whatever team Fee is on has a chance to win a championship.
I'm Christina Williams, host of the podcast In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams. The WNBA playoffs are here, and I've got the inside scoop on everything from key matchups and standout players to the behind-the-scenes moments you won't find anywhere else.
It's really, really hard to be the champions, but we have to remember how it feels and embrace the new challenge that we have.
So listen to In Case You Missed It with Christina Williams, an iHeart Women's Sports production in partnership with Deep Blue Sports and Entertainment on iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is an iHeart podcast.